Tape 23, side 1, May 25th.
Clerk will note those present. All of us are excused. It's a continuation of the hearing dated May 25th, 1977. We're on House Bill 3195. Before us is Mr. Wolf from the Labor Commissioner's Office, Mr. Faddis, and Mr. Demetri. Gentlemen, go right ahead.
My name is Dan Faddis. I represent Metro Electrical Training Trust, the apprenticeship program in the Portland area. The amendments that we've submitted, should have two copies in front of you. One proposed amendment to House Bill 3195 dated May 25th. Another one, Apprenticeship Council Subcommittee proposed amendments to House Bill 3195. Those amendments have been agreed upon by all parties except for Section 3 of the Apprenticeship Council Subcommittee proposed amendments to House Bill 3195. And parties here are here to discuss it.
Now, Mr. Faddis, if I could, so the committee understands this. If the committee would take this three-page document dated May the 25th and mark this amendment number one, and then take the single sheet, and if I could, I only wanted to, if you will divide that sheet into two sections, two amendments, draw a line after the second paragraph and above the line that says Section 3, Section 7, Sub 2, deleted. Draw a line there, and the material above that is going to be amendment number two. And the amendment below that under Section 3 would be amendment number 3. And if I could, okay, now, if you got those marked like that, because that's how I want to talk about it. As I understand it, everyone is agreed on amendment number one, except for that leads in Section 7, subparagraph 2 on page 5. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman.
Where is that located?
It isn't in the bill. It isn't listed at all, and that's the reason why it's in the bill. They have not done anything.
Okay. So when we're talking about Section 7, we're still talking about the printed bill.
Yes, Sub 2.
Okay.
That's the only part that there's a disagreement on is Sub 2.
Yes, although he's talking about the Hannon Gross one, okay, which would include shall.
Now, amendment number 2, everyone has agreed upon that.
Yes.
And amendment number 3 gets back to Section 7, Sub 2, and that's the section that there's no agreement on.
That's correct.
Okay. Now.
Now, do you want a motion to adopt amendment number 1?
First.
And I move that we adopt amendment number 1 to House Bill 3195.
Representative Otto has moved that we adopt amendment number 1, dated May the 25th, 1970. To House Bill 3195. You will note that within that amendment is included the concept that Section 7, Sub 2 on page 5 remains in the bill. Mm-hmm. Is there any further discussion?
Like the paste up we got here that says shall?
Yeah.
All right.
We like the mocked up version that says shall.
Okay.
Is there any further discussion? Any objection? So adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt amendment number 2.
Representative Otto has moved that we adopt amendment number 2 from the Apprenticeship Council Subcommittee proposed amendments to House Bill 3195. On that document, that's Section 1 and 2. Is there any further discussion? Any opposition? So adopted. Now, gentlemen, would you like to debate or tell us why we should follow one proposal over another on Section 3?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Dimitri. As I said before, I'm chairman of the legislative subcommittee of the Apprenticeship Council. And what I report is the report of that subcommittee. In reviewing these, and incidentally, I want to thank the committee for the taking a look at the late changes that we brought forth and including them in the bill and the rest of the thing. That's very fine. And we as a subcommittee unanimously felt that the director of the apprenticeship should be in the classified service as he is at present. We feel that this is a job requiring a lot of knowledge of the industry, of the special relationship that exists between the state and labor and management, and that it should not be a job that a person is, every time we have a new commissioner, that possibility of a change. Getting good men requires offering a certain amount of security, job security. I think it would be very difficult to offer it under this. And in the just in the overall picture of this, it seems that this type of job is not a one that goes with the various directions of political flow, that it is a, we would like to see it possible for people to be moved up, people that are working in the department to someday hope to work their way up to the position of director, although that wouldn't necessarily be the only way that a person would get there, but that's one of the places that they get a great deal of experience. If they are unclassified, then they would have to leave a classified job with its protection in order to take this job.
And for the benefit of the committee, the distinction between the classified and the unclassified service. If you're in the classified service, you fall within the merit system law. You're entitled to all the protections for job security, what other in that area that the merit system law provides. If you're in the unclassified section, you serve basically at the pleasure of the appointing authority. Now, as far as the benefits, you know, like retirement or sick pay, they're just the same. It's the job security element that you lose by going in the unclassified service. And if I understand Mr. Dimitri, what he's concerned about is, one, that the people that are coming up within the department will not want to take that job if it's offered to them, because they will lose their job security.
If
it's in the unclassified service. Because, see, they'll be coming from the classified service, have to give up job security, and go into the unclassified service and serve at the pleasure of the appointing authority. Which your concern is, as I understand it, that if, in fact, it politicizes the position somewhat,
right,
and you're concerned that after a couple of years or a new commissioner comes in, that individual is put out of a job because a new commissioner is in, that he does not have any place else to go. He has no right to employment in the state service any further. If there's a position available, he can apply for it. And that's, I take it, as the basis of your argument.
Yes, I appreciate your putting it into those beautiful words.
Currently, there is someone occupying this position. Is that correct? And that person is in the classified section?
That person is in the classified.
Presently, okay.
See, if you delete that language from the bill, it keeps the law the way it is. He's in the classified section.
Right.
Go ahead. John?
Our position, John Wolf, Bureau of Labor, for the record, is essentially that you have that built-in protection because the council has to confirm the state director of apprenticeship and training. That's in the existing law, and it will remain in the law. law if 3195 were passed. I think that's one reality. Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor is not going to be able to appoint anybody to that position without the confirmation, the agreement of the Apprenticeship and Training Council. So if there is that politicalization, which I suggest can and at times does exist now, even with people in the classified service, and I think that's true throughout state government because of just the nature of the work and how people get to those positions. But you still have that protection, that check or that balance provided by the Apprenticeship and Training Council, even with the director being in the unclassified service. Now, the reason to put the director in the unclassified service essentially is the fact that the director has to answer to the commissioner on a day-to-day basis for the administration of that division. There's been a great deal of talk prior to this session and during this session about expanding the unclassified service in state government, the creation of an executive service, if you will, in order to allow for better administration or improved administration by allowing the chief administrator to appoint certain people, certain positions as unclassified service, serving at the pleasure of that particular individual because of the close relationship that has to exist for the program to operate effectively between those two people. Essentially, that's the Bureau of Labor's position. We contend that the concern that someone may be discouraged from applying to this position really isn't a real concern, and that there is a check or a balance provided by the Apprenticeship and Training Council to any abuse that the present commissioner or any future commissioner might make of this law.
Representative Rogers.
Mr. Chairman, I move the adoption of amendment number 3.
Representative Rogers moves the adoption of amendment number 3, which is in essence the deletion of section 7 sub 2 and retains the present law that says that the director shall be in the classified service.
To the motion, I think that we're talking about something that it's a continuing thing, even though the commissioner may come and go and there may be a change. The system, from what I've been able to determine, has been working well in the way that it's been running with a director in the classified service. Should be a clear letter. I agree with Mr. Dimitri and what he has said to us, and I haven't heard anything that leads me to believe that the system should be changed.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Otto?
No.
Representative Riebel?
Aye.
Representative Rogers?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Kulongoski?
Aye. The amendment is adopted. Representative Otto, do you have any further motion?
I don't see the emergency clause.
It's on the last page of the section 3.
This one. Okay. I would move House Bill 3195 as submitted to the floor for the due pass recommendation.
Representative Otto moves House Bill 3195 as amended to the floor with the due to be engrossed and to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Otto?
Aye.
Representative Riebel?
Aye.
Representative Rogers?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Chairperson Kulongoski?
Aye. House Bill 3195, as amended, is sent to the floor to be engrossed with a due pass recommendation. Gentlemen, I appreciate it.
Being engrossed.
Yeah. I appreciate it very much, and I know it's taking me some time, but I think it's in good order now.
Thank you.
I'm going to open the hearing on House Bill 1048.
And I know that there's some citizens here that want to testify on this bill. And if they would raise their hands, that they've come to testify, would you want to come up together?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to ask you to excuse. I've got to go up for luncheon. But something that keeps coming up and came up again this morning is there seems to be a great deal of misunderstanding by people of just who this change in 1048 is going to apply to. And that bothers, and I'm getting phone calls and letters, and the folks just don't understand how this is going to work. And that last section, section 8, I think.
7.
Is
6, I'm sorry.
No, I'm...
Oh, I'm...
Section 8 applies back to when the various sections become effective. And I would hope that that this would be made clear again.
I think these two ladies, that's exactly why they're here.
Yeah.
They're going to ask you the same question.
Tell to your parents that.
Ladies,
I'll be down.
I hope you
later.
Do not take anything about the committee that some of the members have to leave, but at this time of the session, there are a number of committees going, and a number of the members serve on those other committees, and they have to come and go for votes and things, and we know how serious this issue is with most of the citizens of the state, so you just indulge us somewhat because we do too much sometimes. If you'll both state your name, so she can have it on the tape.
Do you want me first, or
however you want to do it?
All right. My name is Kathleen Springer, and I am the wife of a permanent and total disability person. We live in Portland. Now, I believe, Representative Kulongoski, that you have a letter from me.
I do.
Yes. So I had a prepared statement also. I would like, if it's permissible, to make several remarks other than the typed.
You say whatever you want.
Statement. Okay. Because these things I realized a little bit later. I would like to call your attention to the caption of the Oregonian of 5/20/77. Workman's bill okayed over howls of labor, comma, lawyers. Quoting Senator Anthony Meeker, that in 1976, SAIF spent $1.6 million in attorney fees, plus another $1.5 million in defending appeals cases, and this amounts to $3.1 million. Now, gentlemen, I ask you, I'm not going to make any friends of any attorney, and I realize that. And I'm not putting down the bar.
You won't offend me.
Okay. But this boggles my mind. It simply is mind-boggling. Now, I'm an old moss-backed Oregonian, a fifth-generation Oregonian, to be exact. And these tremendous amounts of money that are quoted just simply floor me. But now here, in our particular instance, we are getting by on the minimum. When my husband was injured the second time, we got no lump sum. We didn't ask for a lump sum. We didn't try to sue anybody. All we asked was that he be given enough to get along on, and if he were taken, that I would be provided for. Okay. Now, this bill comes along, and at age 65, his state workman's comp will be cut by half. At age 70, if he should live that long, it will be eliminated completely. This man gets $155 a month from Social Security. Now, I have been in contact with the office in Portland with a gentleman by the name of Mr. Campbell, and he informs me after checking through my husband's file, he, at age 65, will still get $155 a month. Now, where does this leave us? this leaves us destitute. Unless I can go and put enough pressure on the Veterans Administration to give us, or me, or him, or both of us, enough money to live on. Now, something is very, very amiss. And I think that this bill, as it is written, does not solve any of these problems. I was always under the impression that workman's comp was for the benefit of the worker, not for vested medical people, nor not for legal people. But let me tell you, it just isn't working that way. And I think something should be done. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Go right ahead.
Okay. I'm Virginia Hughes, only it's H-E-W-E-S. I'm from Portland. And I'm also against this part of the bill because I think it discriminates against the injured worker and older people in particular. And it is my understanding of this bill is, if is correct, I would receive half of my monthly payment from the workman's compensation to the age after age 65, then nothing after 70. All right, in my particular case, I was injured on the job, and I'm still fighting with the workman's compensation appeal. I haven't received anything within a year's time. And I've had a hearing there for a year, but I have received no word of it and no compensation through it. And I did not have time to cure my Social Security benefits or any pension plan. Therefore, I'm unable to collect on any of that. And so I would have to go to my husband's and collect it after it's 65, which he has had a stroke. And I'm supposed to be, should have been able to work and provide too. But with us both injured, where does it leave us? So I think this bill should be either tabled or done something, because I don't feel that's fair to any worker to cut them off at age 70 when they need more care, more heat. And what if I had to hire somebody to take care of me?
Mrs. Hughes, I take it that the part of the bill that you're most concerned about is that part of the bill that begins on page 5. And if you ladies have a copy of the bill with you, it would begin on page 5, section 6, that in essence decreases the amount of your workman's compensation payment at age 65, and as Mrs. Springer said, until age 70 when it's completely eliminated. That's the part of the bill I take it.
That's the part of the bill I think is discriminating to the injured worker and the older people, because where does that leave me in my case? And I'm sure there's several more as to mine that didn't get their benefits from Social Security or anything, or any pension plans, and yet we're surviving on what he has, and yet they haven't paid me in the last year.
Thank you, George.
Was it Mrs. Hughes?
Yes. Yeah. Only it's H-E-W-E-S.
What is the reason that your case hasn't been resolved?
I don't know. I've called them several times. I've called the attorney, and they say, well, there's lots of these cases like this. We've had the hearing on June the 25th, 1976. I have received no word.
And is it a private insurance carrier involved?
No,
or is
it's
it
the
safe?
Workman's Compensation Board. Mm-hmm. That I'm before. And John McLeod, or Lloyd, or whatever, however they pronounce it, was the hearing officer. And I think they should have paid me from this back year, but I have nothing. Now, what am I going to do after 70? And I'm sure there's more cases than this that's out. If you get hurt on the job, you don't get your Social Security accrued nor your pension plans, where are you going to be?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Sorry it took you so long today, and we could hear to this bill for you.
That's right.
It's difficult to sit in those chairs that long.
Well, it's just a little difficult for him because he's out in the hall.
Oh. I would like the
Mr. Chairman, written, yes. I might add that these two ladies sat through 2 hours of a breakfast meeting last Saturday morning out in Gresham also.
Yes. So did he. I brought Mr. Hughes along because I have nobody to leave him with.
Then there Thank you very much. I would like the testimony of Mrs. Springer and Mrs. Hughes entered into the record.
They have provided the committee with written testimony and will be made part of the record. You know, Carl, I see Carl and Jack out there, and I think that they must be a little uncomfortable when they see the four of us sitting up here. I can't believe that the Republicans have that much faith in me that they honestly would let us four sit here at least with some advanced warning device into this so that they could run out in the hall and haul somebody in here.
Oh, we've got the doors locked, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. George Burney? George, do you and Bill want to come up together? Mr. Burney and Mr. Barlow are going to come up to testify together.
Mr. Chairman, my name is George Burney, and I represent the American Insurance Association. Bill Barlow represents the American Mutual Insurance Alliance.
He's there with at the witness table.
He's at the witness table with me, and between us, our companies perhaps write around a little over 40% of the total privately written workman compensation premium in Oregon. We support the provisions of Senate Bill 1048.
George, you're going to have to speak up. They can't hear you in the back. Is that on?
He means to direct it towards himself.
Oh. Okay, George.
It's on. Chairman, we support the provisions of Senate Bill 1048. And although normally we do not, as insurance companies, participate in negotiations between employers and employees and their groups regarding such matter as compensation benefits. We do feel that we have to inject ourselves into the picture where we feel that the matter of benefits or the deductions from benefits affects something more than just the benefits themselves and perhaps goes to the foundations of the very workman's compensation law. And we feel that Section 5 of the bill which contains the Social Security Disability Offset provisions is of such nature as to cause us to inject ourselves into this controversy and to indicate to the committee that we would like to see Section 5 eliminated. We base this not on the fact that it's not really a great concern to the underwriters that the employees participate in the payment of Social Security premiums and are entitled to this benefit, nor that the benefit itself, when allowed to be offset by in the way provided by the bill, amounts to, say, $4 million savings to the employers, which is about something under 2% of the total workman's compensation premium paid in Oregon. But rather that we feel that our people have worked with Congress in the last 6 or 8 years to make the state workman's compensation laws over the entire 50 states truly a state-operated and controlled piece of legislation. And we feel that to go ahead and to permit the Social Security disability offset, not the retirement, but the disability, would undermine to help undermine the state system and bring us closer and perhaps more quickly into a situation where federals would come in and start to control what we're doing in Oregon. I'd like to read for a moment, Mr. Chairman, a statement in a letter of our people on this very subject, because it states it much more succinctly and more quickly than I can state it just by ad-libbing. For 7 years, the insurance industry supported federal legislation to eliminate disincentives resulting from duplication of benefits and to recognize the importance of maintaining the integrity of state workers' compensation benefit programs. As a result of this advocacy, federal legislation was passed in 1965 to provide that workers could receive up to 80% of their average current earnings in combined Social Security and workers' compensation benefits. In other words, the worker doesn't get 100%. If he is getting also workers' compensation, then the federal law says he can get 80% of that average earnings. This legislation provided that workers' compensation benefits be paid first, with the Social Security system making up the difference in disability benefits. In other words, the primacy was with the state act and not with the federal system. This legislation was viewed as maintaining the integrity of the individual state's programs for workers' compensation. The federal law also provides that should a state reduce its workers' compensation benefits as a result of Social Security disability benefits paid, and that's what this bill purports to do, then the 80% limitation will be removed and the full Social Security disability benefits will be paid. So if this bill should become law, then the worker is not paid 80% of the benefits. He's paid the full 100% of the benefits and the disability benefits. And it's that that we'd be working against in the offset. Thus, states which enact Social Security disability offsets are shifting primary responsibility for payment of compensation to disabled workers from the states to the federal Social Security system. And that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is the essence of our position. We feel very strongly on this. We know that by urging this position that we are running against, contrary to the intentions of our friends, the employers. But we feel so strongly, and having we've worked this vineyard very carefully for these last 9 years, and so strongly do we feel it, that even though we may have to antagonize our friends, we think that ultimately it's going to have to be that way in order to preserve our Oregon system. The Washington has a similar system. It now has the offset. Oregon used to have it a couple of years ago, and then it was so screwed up that they decided to, I think it lasted one session. I think there's not more than 4 states in the union, 50 states that have enacted this type of legislation. I don't know how many are cooking now, but we fully support desires and efforts made by the employers and the employee groups to reduce the cost of workers' compensation. But we feel that this item of cost, amounting to not more than 1.5 or 2% of the total premium, is so insignificant in view of the possible harm that it can bring upon our state control system that it should be eliminated. We have a few technical amendments, too. I think Mr. Barlow would like to address himself to those that, in other parts of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Barlow.
Mr. Chairman,
can I ask a question?
Yes.
And there was testimony during the interim, and I'm not sure if we've had testimony during the session on this particular thing in the House committee, but because Social Security was so low, the people that were reaching close to retirement age would actually do as much as they could to get off in workman's comp to get that benefit. Kind of what you're saying then is you don't really feel that that's enough, or that's enough, or this is enough a disincentive to change that, or that isn't a big enough concern.
I haven't heard that concern expressed, Mr. Lindquist. I haven't. you mean they want to get off Social Security so that they they want to get off workman's comp?
It's an employee situation. He's reaching retirement age. The outfit that he works for doesn't have a retirement system, so he's facing Social Security. But he knows that workman's comp pays much better, so if he can get off on a back injury or something, the incentive actually, under the present system, it's been testified before the interim committee, that the incentive was for him to go off on workman's comp so that he would get a lot more money than Social Security.
Well, the disability, Social Security disability, is not to be confused with the Social Security or old age benefits. We're just addressing ourselves to the disability, which normally would end when he was 65 years of age. We're in no way are addressing ourselves to the problem of the old age benefits, and we have no position whether they should be deducted or not.
Okay. Fine. I didn't read Section 5. I was just listening to you.
George, yours is a philosophical opposition to the concept.
Well,
it's the role of the federal government in the state program.
Yes, if that's philosophical, why then my concern of my client is philosophical. But we feel it's basic, as well as being philosophical. I'm not so sure I know what meaning philosophical is in this time, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Go ahead, Bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to repeat George's testimony. The position of the alliance is substantially the same. We oppose it on the... We like the bill, but we do oppose this particular part of it on philosophical grounds. I distributed some material to the members of the committee that discusses the offset to generally. It does not address this particular type of offset, but it should clarify how the thing works and what the effects may be. We do have a couple mechanical problems with the bill. Section 1, subsection 4 provides that the board shall secure information on the worker's income, and if he's working, the board can then use this information to reduce his benefits. And there's no provision in here for communicating any of this information to the insurer or the employer. And we feel that some amendment would be appropriate in there to make this information available to the employer or the carrier that's covering or providing these benefits.
Bill, there's been a proposed amendment. If you'd look at the bill, it's been proposed on line 28 that the sentence beginning with "if at any time," that complete sentence be deleted. The reason is that I think as it was stated the other day, that the board's power to modify, its power of continuing jurisdiction already picks that up. And I have problems with the way that sentence is stated. And I think that everyone's agreed, basically, that could come out. But yours has to do with more of supplying the information the board receives back to the carrier.
Making it available to the carrier and the employer, too. We could supply some wording on that.
Could you do that?
If you'd like.
Sure. It would be just such information shall be forwarded to the carrier and the employer.
Yeah, something of that kind. We can make it available to the council.
Okay. Go ahead.
The other thing that we would like to bring up is Section 1.5 provides that each case be examined periodically to determine if the worker is incapacitated, and we feel that this should be modified to exclude some cases where there's absolutely nothing to be accomplished by reviewing them. If you've got a man who's lost both of his legs or a paraplegic or this kind of thing, this periodic review would be pointless and just an extra burden.
Could you draft an amendment?
We can do that, Mr. Chairman.
If you will look over on page 3, it's also been proposed that on line 4, after the word re-examination, that a period be inserted there and the remainder of the sentence be deleted, again under the same rationale of the board's continuing jurisdiction over cases already picks that up, and I don't think that language needs to be in there.
Okay, we'll take a look at that and see how it affects it.
Okay. Are those the only amendments that you have?
That's all we have.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Thank you very
much.
Is Mr. Lamb here? Mr. Lamb, would you come up?
Thank you. casualty actuary for the insurance division in the state of Oregon. I have some estimates with me of the effects of various provisions of the Senate Bill 1048. I'd like to mention that these estimates are the effect of this bill beyond any effects of changes in the average statewide average weekly wage or any other effects of existing law, and also independent of any other 1977 legislation. And they are, they contain several approximations, so any other person or organization which might make other estimations may use slightly different assumptions to come up with slightly different answers. I do feel they represent the best possible estimates at this time.
Michael, I think they're having trouble in the back hearing you. Could you speak a little louder, please?
Okay. To begin with, the first three sections make some changes in the definition of the permanent total and how to be administered, and there's nothing there I could really work with on any kind of quantitative techniques or anything. So I would not want to represent to you what the effect of that, those sections would be. However, I would expect that there would be no immediate premium change for those sections. Any effect from them that was realized in the claim experience would eventually be also reflected in the premium rates. Section 5 is the first place where there's anything I can really work on. There are some assumptions that have to be made for Section 5. The first assumption is what percentage of the permanent total claims in Oregon, permanent total claimants in Oregon, would be eligible for federal disability benefits. And there's been a wide range of opinions on this percentage. Some sources have believed that this percentage would be comparable to that percentage to that portion of permanent totals in Oregon, which would correspond to the volume of permanent totals in other states. Comparing the permanent totals in other states, it appears that if that assumption is correct, that only about 20% of the permanent totals in Oregon would be eligible.
Can I stop you there? Mm-hmm. What you're saying then is that only 20%.
Well, that's one opinion.
Oh, one opinion. What you're talking about is the percentage of Oregon citizens on permanent total disability who would also be on disability under Social Security.
Yes.
And one figure you've just given is 20% of the permanent totals in Oregon would also be permanently disabled under Social Security. Okay. So I understand what you're...
The reason this question arises is been stated quite often, is very true, that we have a higher proportion of a higher volume of permanent total claims in proportion to our working population in Oregon than other states have. And so the thing is, for some reason or another, some of these might not be eligible for the standards for permanent total in Oregon may not be the same as the Social Security Administration requirements. The 20% is kind of the lowest opinion. Other opinions have it that nearly all of the permanent totals in Oregon would be eligible. I'm not able to really pinpoint what the percentage would be, and the best estimate I would like to give to you assumes that 50% would be eligible. I also have some figures that would, on what the effect would be if all of them were eligible. I can give you those. I believe that 50% is probably the best estimate that I can come up with. Another assumption that has to be made in for Section 5 is exactly what the how the Social Security Administration would administer their benefits in the event that the permanent total benefit for Oregon was greater than this limitation on that the Social Security disability benefit requires. However, on after consulting with some persons within the Social Security Administration, I didn't contact them. Other persons contacted them. And looking at the Social Security Act itself, it now appears that Social Security Administration would cooperate with the way this is worded, and it appears to be the intent that they would pay their full benefit and allow the Oregon benefit to be offset, to be reduced. So with those explanations, I have estimated that Section 5, both subsections together, would reduce the cost of permanent total claims by approximately 21%. 21%. And the overall effect of this on the total claim cost and the premium would be a reduction of about 4.7%, 4.7%.
Okay. Mike, can I ask you a question? The figures that you used to arrive at the 21%, what was the total number of permanent totals that you were using as the figure that you took 50% of?
I don't work with the number of claims. I work with the dollar amounts of claims.
Okay. Why don't you give me the dollar amount that you work with?
Well, I don't have a dollar amount that would correspond to any period of time.
Okay.
What I look at is the kind of the distribution of types of claims, what sort of claims there are, and as far as what type of dependence each claimant has, and so forth. The only time I come to using a dollar figure is when I try to get a weight to apply to the permanent total effect.
Okay, now I want to make sure I understand it. You're saying that the total dollar value of permanent total disability claims will be reduced by 21% if Section 5 passes.
That's my best estimate.
And that will be reflected by a 4.7 reduction in premium cost to the employer.
Yes, the permanent total claim costs are, I forget exactly, I think it's about 21% of the total cost. And that percent applied to this 21% reduction comes up with a 4.7% overall effect.
Now that's using the 50% figure.
Yes. That assumes that half of the permanent totals in Oregon would be eligible for federal disability.
I understand. Go ahead.
Okay. On to Section 6.
Now, what was the figure you used for 100%? Did you compute that
okay.
out?
If the 100% of all permanent totals in Oregon were eligible for federal disability, the reduction in the claim cost for permanent total cost would be 41.9%. The overall effect is a savings of 9.3%.
9.3% is the premium.
Yes.
Okay, I understand. Yeah, go right ahead, Anita.
Weren't your original calculations lower?
Yes, they were.
What factors caused you to change your mind?
Mostly this one that I mentioned earlier, where I had previously assumed that in the instance where the permanent total benefit for workman's compensation was larger than this federal maximum for disability, that the offset would not work as it appears to be intended. That I had believed that the Social Security people would look at the total and see it was over 80 and start to reduce theirs, and eventually it would disappear. And that does not appear to be the way it would work. So with that new information, I've revised my savings or estimates, and there's a slightly greater savings.
Did you hear Mr. Bernie's and Mr.
Earl's testimony here this morning from the insurance industry.
Yes.
I take it that these figures, if I can just get a nod of the head, substantiate your position, which you're concerned about.
Well, our figures are a little different.
I can explain the difference.
Okay.
I've seen the information they've alluded to. Essentially, what it is, the difference is that their figure is based on the 20%, or something like the 20% of permanent totals being eligible for federal disability.
I understand.
I believe that's correct.
I'll call him back up.
Right.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
Section 6, then, I've worked on both parts of Section 6. Subsection 1 is the section which begins to phase out the permanent total benefits beginning at age 65 and eliminates it entirely at age 70. The effect of this is a savings of 26 and 6 tenths, or almost 30% of the permanent total claim costs. And overall, the effect is a savings of 6 6/10.
Okay, now I want to stop you there again so I make sure that I understand it. If subsection 1 is implemented, that you're saying that 30% of the total dollar value of the permanent total disability claims, 30% of those, mm-hmm. I mean the cost of that dollar value will be reduced by 30%.
Yes.
Okay. And that's reflecting how much a percentage decrease in premium cost?
The overall effect would be a reduction of 6 6/10.
Okay.
And what? 6.6?
Yes, 6.6 tenths%. Okay, go right ahead.
Subsection 2 of Section 6. The section where provides an additional benefit equal to the loss of the federal retirement amount, which would be reduced because the worker had lower earnings where he was credited in the Social Security retirement. That difference would be made up by an additional benefit. Cost of that benefit would add back 32 9/10% of the cost of permanent total claims, or overall increase of 7 3/10%.
7 3/10. No.
Yes.
I don't mean to be rhetorical with some of the questions, but they're more for information for the full
right.
committee. What you're saying is that if Section 1 were implemented, there would be a reduction in of the total dollar cost of 30%, which would represent a 6.6% premium decrease.
Yes.
But by adding back into the law Section 2, what you're saying is, as to a dollar cost increase to the workman's compensation system, there's a 32.9% increase.
Yes.
Which is a 7.3% premium increase.
Correct.
And I take it your next step is you're going to subtract these two figures and tell us what, looking at Section 6 in total, what it really gets down to the bottom line.
Well, I can do that for you, I guess.
Well, it's 2.9 and point, what is it?
Well, no, the figure I gave for Section, subsection 1 was 29.6 or about 30.
I'm sorry. 29?
So the difference is that 3 3/10%?
Yes.
Of
that's
permanent total
that's
cost.
Dollar. That's dollars.
Of permanent total claim costs. And overall, the effect on total claim costs and premiums would be an increase of about, let's see, 7 10/%.
So you're saying that Section 6 is going overall, under your estimate, cause an increase in premiums?
Yes. 0.7%. I suppose, again, these figures are quite approximate. There are a lot of assumptions involved, and I'm not sure you could say that 0.7 is a lot different than zero.
Yeah, I understand that.
Or different than some higher.
What I think is more important, you, at least under your figures and your assumptions, is you're saying it's going to have no effect, basically, on premium costs.
Right.
Section 6.
Section 6, if both sections are included, very little change.
Go right ahead.
So the overall effect, then, of all the total bill, or Sections 5 and 6, is a reduction in permanent total claim cost of 17.7%.
Or what was that? I'm sorry. 17?
17.7. Or an overall reduction of 3.9.
That's a premium.
Premium or total claim cost. Now, again, the assumption of what percent of permanent totals are eligible for federal disability comes into this. If 100% were eligible, the reduction would be 38.6%.
Again, I'm sorry.
38.6% of permanent total claim costs, or an overall reduction of 8.6%.
Okay.
That assumption does not affect Section 6.
Okay.
The assumption of what percent would be eligible for disability.
Mike, do you have that written, your testimony written for him?
No, I don't.
Could you do that? Could you take the figures you've given? I've written them all down, but could you provide a copy of your testimony just with your assumptions and with the figures that you have for the committee?
All right. Who do I send that to?
If you'll give it to the committee clerk, she'll see that I get it and all the other committee members. And
all right.
As soon as Mr. Lamb has that over here, that it'll be available for anyone that wants to pick it up from the committee clerk. Jim, would you also mark that spot on the tape where Mr. Lamb started? Would you transcribe it for me? Thank you.
Hope they turn out to be the same.
I hope so. Thank you very much, Mr. Lamb. Any questions? Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Bob Kennedy?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, I'm Bob Kennedy, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO. On late Wednesday, the 17th, I was in conversation, I was told that...
Just a second, Bob. John, I don't think we're going to get to 3:10 today, because I'm going to have to let everybody go to lunch very shortly. Okay, go ahead, Bob.
That Mr. Lamb was working on a fiscal analysis for Senate Bill 1048A engrossed, and so later I had a telephone conversation with him, and I see that he has revised his figures from what my testimony states here, so you'll have to strike the 1, as it's only 0.7% then. Could be saved by the deletion of Section 6 of the printed bill. And as you know, that many of our members are unhappy with this provision in the bill, and then as well as other people. And since Mr. Lamb's figures show a reduction could be made in the workman's compensation premiums if the bill was amended to remove Section 6, the Oregon AFL-CIO therefore respectfully submits the following amendments. On page 5 of printed A engrossed bill, delete lines 24 through 34. On page 6, delete lines 1 through 11.
Bob, you're just proposing the deletion of Section 6.
Yes, sir. Then I also had, it would be a house cleaning on the renumbering in line 12, which would delete 7, insert 6, and in line 25, delete 8, insert 7. And also then on page 6, you'd have to delete lines 31, 32, if you did, because that does pertain to section 6. And with those amendments, the Oregon AFL-CIO supports Senate Bill 1048 A. Engrossed.
Okay. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Mr. Hannon? Mr. Hannon isn't here. I'd let the record show that Mr. Leroy Hannon, representing the Oregon Foreign Bureau, was signed up to testify in favor of A. Engrossed Senate Bill 1048 without Mr. Kennedy's amendments. Is there anyone else that cares to testify on 1048? Carl?
You'll want this on the record. Carl Frederick, member of the staff, Associate Oregon Industry. We will support the AFL-CIO amendments to strike Section 6.
I appreciate that very much.
You're welcome.
Mark, you made a decision. Very easy.
It was an easy decision to make, sir.
Raise the flag.
Thank you very much.
I didn't take modern math, but...
Jack?
Me too.
Let the record show that Jack Kalinowski of the Associated General Contractors spoke in favor of the deletion of Section 6 out of the bill. And Steve Telfer, representing the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, and the Oregon School Boards Association, also this date testified in favor of the deletion of Section 6 from the A. Engrossed version of Senate Bill 1048.
Good job, Bob.
Is there anyone else that... Would you ladies like to come back up here and we'll explain to you what happened? Come right up here.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Now, my question is this.
Identify yourself.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I'm sorry. Kathleen Springer, Portland, Oregon. My question is this. All right. Now, Section 6 being deleted. Okay. What I'm wondering is this. As time goes on or at a certain date, will the Social Security disability benefits that are being received presently, as I quoted before, $155 a month, will those be deducted from the amount that he is receiving from SAIF or Workman's Comp?
Mr. Wyman, have you heard that? I believe the answer to your question is no. Mr. Wyman is the committee administrator and legal counsel for the Senate Labor Committee that worked very hard on this bill. Dick, why don't you come up here and answer that? Did you hear the question?
Yes.
Section 5 will not result in a increase or decrease in combined benefits. Totally, presently we have a combined benefit situation in this case where Workman's Comp is taking the first bite of the combined benefit, and Social Security is playing the increment. $155 is much below what their computed benefit would be. The reason why it's so small is that they are reducing their benefit by the amount that the state pays. The bill turns that around, and Social Security would pay their full computed benefit, which would be probably between $500 and $700. The state then would be responsible for that portion up to the present combined benefit. This is why we were careful to take care of both situations in Section 5, so that it spells out. Very definitely that a reduction shall not be made below what the current combined benefit is.
Ladies, if you'll look in page 5, if I'm not mistaken, that is in subparagraph B.
if you would look at that, that's the part that Mr. Wyman's talking about. Go ahead, Dick.
The reason why we have two sections there is that we have two different cases. In some cases, our state benefit is higher than the federal ceiling, and therefore we would not want the effect of the bill to bring those people who are at a higher level down to the federal ceiling. In some cases, we have, in this case, where you're receiving both workman's comp and federal Social Security, that indicates that the state benefit is lower than the maximum that the federal would pay, so that they are paying on top. And in her case, or the case of her situation, Section B would apply if the benefit amount to which the workman is entitled is less than the federal disability benefit limitation determined by the Social Security law. The reduction in workman's compensation benefits shall not be administered in such manner as to lower the amount of combined benefits the workman receives below the federal benefit limitation. So the limitation of your combined benefit would stay the same. What the bill really does in Section 5 is that it means that Social Security is going to be taking first bite rather than us. And it does save money as far as to the state system. Your combined benefits would not be affected. In other words, your benefit level is not going to change.
I understand.
Put it in another way, as a dollar value, there will be no reduction in the dollar value of your husband's permanent total disability.
I understand, yes.
It's just a shift from the workman's comp system to the Social Security system picking up part of it.
Well, I would like to say, and of course, as I said in my letter, I may be dense, but in reading through this bill, when I got the copy, I got cool shivers because I thought, and this is when I contacted Social Security, and I said, okay, now, is Social Security going to make up the difference? And they said, well, no, of course they're not going to make up the difference. You don't have anything to base your benefits on. And so this is when I started getting frightened because I thought, here we'll be with this man in the shape that he's in, requiring all these medications and good stuff, and no way to pay for them. And so this is when I started getting just a mite upset.
See, that's how effective you two ladies are.
In my case, though, if he should not survive very long, and I have my Social Security isn't accrued, I have no pension plan either, and they can discontinue this at 70, where am I at?
Well, we support the deletion of Section 6. I'm sure I speak for Senator Groner as well as other members of the committee.
That's being deleted out of the bill.
That's going to be deleted.
That's going to be taken out of the bill.
We support that deletion.
We support that to be deleted.
Yes.
And from this, I'd be all right.
Well, your benefit would stay the same. It would turn into a survivor's benefit, which, as I'm sure you're aware, would be basically the same benefit that's been drawn by your spouse.
Thank you
very much, ladies. I appreciate you coming down. Is there anyone else?
Well, I just have two points.
Please, go ahead.
First of all, the point being that to Mr. Burney's testimony that they felt that Section 5 would result in an increase in benefits. On the other side of the coin, Section 5 will not result in an increase. I just explained why it would not result in a decrease. But there's nothing in Section 5 that would authorize an increase in benefits. Benefits stay status quo. Also, I have had a conversation with the Region 10 Social Security Administrator who would have preferred that the offset under this bill be taken on all types of payments, that is, all time loss, temporary total, as well as permanent total disability payments. It would be easier for them to administrate. They were hoping that they would not have to phase in with the state system. Of course, now on each claim, they have to phase in with the state system and figure each claim separately. My feeling is that, yes, it would have been administratively easier for them if it had gone, had taken the full benefits into this bill, but their condition is not going to be any worse because currently they're having to calculate each separate benefit anyway, and the state board will be the one, the state workman's comp board is the one who will identify these people and send the release up, so Social Security will have an easy way of knowing which benefits are affected. And
yes, we have to go to session. You're very sharp.
That's
before Glenn leaves. Thank you. Mm-hmm. What I'm going to do is that we're going to take all the amendments proposed. I will have Mr. Barlow, if you will get me the amendments, can you have those by Monday?
Certainly.
Okay, if you will have those amendments by Monday, I'm going to have the clerk have legislative counsel draft a series of amendments to incorporate all the amendments that were suggested and then bring them back to the committee so I can get a printed version of the bill so people have a more accurate understanding of exactly what the status of the bill is at this particular time. Glenn, Ed, before you leave, I'm going to move for the introduction of a bill, a committee bill at the request of the Committee on Labor relating to employment safety. It's LC number 2712, prohibits issuance of citation for repeat violations of Oregon Safe Employment Act unless the violations occurred in same geographical location. It's the repeat violation bill. I move to have it introduced. Is there any objections? Hearing none, it's so introduced. Is there anything else to come before the committee? I would like the members to be aware that I intend next week to start committee hearings in the evening on workman's comp, and I will be contacting you as far as the time. Yes, Jack. Thank you.
Several of us are still very, very concerned about Senate Bill 310. You did not hear it today. Your scheduling problems are aware. We're aware of.
That will be set for an evening hearing when we set the time schedule up. I intend to bring the bill back up. Anything else to come before the committee?
Friday or is not?
Yes. The committee, the session starts at 9:30, if I'm not mistaken, Friday. Does it not? Do we have anything on the agenda for Friday?
We canceled the agenda for Friday.
Okay. I'm going to do right now, 10:50 is in the committee. I wanted a special notice to go out that I'm going to bring 10:50 up for at least an hour and a half Friday morning so I can start on it. Anything else?
Then Friday is not canceled.
No, Friday is not going to be canceled. It's going to start at 8 and we'll be done at 9:30 so I can start working on 10:50. Anything else to come before the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.
Well, I'm not going to
and then the American.
Yes, don't put the H and Kelly Rebel Chansey there. This guy's not gonna let them in the same church, but yes, said America. Then yes, and here's the Terry Hoyas, ain't it? They're foreign one and go on beat out of this wide and the source, don't see it, stop, but they ain't it. The person she has in the park in the world, he ain't all from one day. They're foreign one and it. Oh, what did I say to go? Don't see it, there's a lot of two more, but she ain't got you, they ain't.
May 27th, public hearing on Senate Bill 1050, Tape 23, Side 1. Anything, but it's on. Yes. Well, I'm in a complete version. Plus 28,
20 on Monday. Ted, I've got a bill in next door that when it comes up, they're going to come.
Yes.
Have you banged the gavel? Oh, here.
The committee will come to order. The clerk will note those present. All others are excused. Today, as most of you know, the session starts at 9:30. It was an informational session on House Bill 2050. You all know that there is another bill in the House Labor Committee. It's one of the benefits of being the chairman, House Bill 2658, which is also a bill that deals with something of the same subject matter. Before I call anyone up, I want to bring Mr. Wyman. Dick? Mr. Wyman, for those in the public that do not know, is the counsel to the Senate Labor Committee, and he was involved in the drafting of 1050. And what I've asked him to do, both for the committee and for the citizens in here that wish to testify, is to give a very brief rundown of what the bill is, so that if anyone has any questions, maybe after listening to what he says, that you'll have a better understanding of exactly what was done with the Senate. Dick?
Thank you. Richard Wyman, legal counsel for the Senate Labor Committee, representing Senator Groner. Senate Bill 1050 is before you today as another element in the total workman's compensation reform package, which the Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs in the Senate developed throughout this session of the legislature. The measure is basically an attack on the hidden or indirect cost of workman's compensation system and proposes changes in the present administrative and appeals structure. Testimony before our committee indicated a growing need to separate the administrative and the quasi-judicial functions created by the law. All parties to a contested claim, the employer, the insurer, and most of all the injured worker, must be assured that the final determination of a claim will be made as rapidly as possible. The consequences of a delayed final determination are both expensive to the employer and disastrous to the injured worker. Data on rehabilitation programs in this and other states indicate that the gap between the injury and the rehabilitation, as that gap increases, the chance of an injured worker returning to work diminishes. After 12 months, there are heavy odds against the possibility that he will ever re-enter the labor market. We are currently seeing a 14 to 18 month gap. For this reason, we proposed in Senate Bill 1050 that the Workman's Compensation Board be freed from the administrative task so that it can devote its full time and energy to hearing appeals from the referee's decisions in contested cases. We believe this will result in timely final determinations and a much earlier entry of the injured worker into programs of physical and vocational rehabilitation. If this is achieved, we can expect reduced cost in the permanent total disability area, as well as a general reduction in the overall time loss compensation. administrative task will be handled by a separate department headed by a director. The decisions of the director are subject to review by the board, and the board retains its responsibility of making final determinations in contested cases. Senate Bill 1050 also remedies another major indirect cost of the current system, the five-step de novo review process. The present appeals process provides for five separate reviews of the evidence in the record. Each of the reviewing bodies hears the evidence de novo and may substitute its judgment completely for the judgment of the body below. It also means that the courts are the final judges on every aspect of a claim, including facts and evidence. We've heard testimony that the courts, in some instances, have taken the workers' compensation laws far afield of the intent of the legislature. When the legislature passed the law, it delegated responsibility to an administrative board, the Workers' Compensation Board. This board is required by statute to be composed of a representative of labor, a representative of management, and a neutral to represent the public. The board is answerable to the legislature, which has the power to review the policies and decisions of the board and correct abuses by legislation. The legislature does not have the power to review or alter decisions by the courts. Therefore, we propose in Senate Bill 1050 that the board render the final decisions on the facts and evidence. Senate Bill 1050 eliminates the power of the circuit courts to review. Review by the circuit courts has resulted in the judges of many different judicial districts, some of whom have little knowledge of the workers' compensation system, second-guessing the Workers' Compensation Board by substituting their judgments on the evidence. Therefore, instead of a three-member board representing the interest of labor, management, and the public, a single judge may make his evaluation of the facts and develop policy. The system cannot bear the cost of inconsistency and delay caused by the circuit courts taking a fourth look at the evidence. By abolishing circuit court review, we have no intention of depriving the parties of judicial review on matters of law. Senate Bill 1050 provides that the Court of Appeals will review determinations of the board on the grounds of substantial evidence and errors of law. This change is consistent with the review exercised by the Court of Appeals in reviewing the decisions of other administrative bodies. The Court of Appeals will serve as watchdog on the board to assure that all decisions have met with the standards of due process and reasonableness, and that the decision is supported by substantial evidence. The Supreme Court, of course, may accept review of any compensation case after it has been reviewed by the Court of Appeals. Under Senate Bill 1050, there would be four separate evaluations of the facts in a case. First, by the Evaluations Division. Second, on reconsideration by the Evaluations Division. Third, by an independent referee. Fourth, by the Workers' Compensation Board. The Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court would then review the board's decisions for errors of law and to determine whether the board's decision is supported by substantial evidence. The board will be the ultimate judge of the facts. The board decision deviates from the intent of the law. The legislature will have the ability to correct the situation by legislation. Presently, the legislature can do nothing but hope that the courts will administer the workers' compensation law in line with that law's intent. By the steps I've mentioned, Senate Bill 1050 will promote timely and consistent determinations of contested cases and thereby early entry of the injured worker into rehabilitation programs. We must remember that the workers' compensation law was passed to benefit the injured worker and not to provide an opportunity for extended and expensive litigation on the same set of facts. When the law was passed, the main responsibility was delegated to an administrative board. Unless the legislature wishes to change that decision and transfer that responsibility to the courts, we must reaffirm that the board shall serve as the final judge of the facts in a contested case, and the court will serve in its proper capacity to review matters of law. We feel that Senate Bill 1050 only reaffirms the original legislative intent of the workers' compensation law. We have watched the compensation laws become more and more a court-administered program with no chance of legislative review. It's time to turn that tide with Senate Bill 1050. And if you have any questions on the bill as it's drafted, I'd be glad to answer those.
Bill, Rich, have you prepared any kind of a chart that shows the relationship
of one to the other.
Bill, it's interesting. I was going to ask Rick to go over to the blackboard and draw a schematic diagram of the board and the director.
In going through the bill itself, I'm not sure that I've got everyone placed in their proper position. For instance, in here it says that the decisions by the director are subject to review by the board, and I don't know whether that means administrative decisions or just what kind of decisions. So I would like to see some kind of a chart, an organizational chart, showing how these all tie together. And once we, and in the function of the a director and the board is what I'm specifically talking about.
Can you do that for us?
Well, I don't have a chart prepared. Basically, how the statute was drafted, we went through the laws, looked at the laws, and determined what would be sections pertaining to purely administrative responsibilities. And changed in the law, changed the word from board to director, so that it was in the director's power. The director basically has the major powers the director will have will be to administer the program, and this would be that he'll have control over the rehabilitation program at Wilsonville, for instance. He will be have administrative control over the compliance division. The various physical activities of the board, that is, raising the tax, seeing that compliance is met, administering the various funds that are created by it. Section 30 is the section which gives the board the basic policy-making power. It's our intent to leave the policy-making duties in the board, and also the power of the board on its own motion to review orders and rules made by the director. I'm sorry that I do not have a chart describing all the various administrative tasks that would be in the director. Keith Wilson from the Workers' Compensation Board is here, and he might be able to give you a broader idea of what the purely administrative duties of the board currently are and which of those would naturally be transferred to the director.
I'm sure it would be real helpful to all of us if mm-hmm. we had a 11 by 17 or something.
Now, this, the director will have charge of the evaluation division.
Yes.
He will have charge of the compliance division.
Yes.
He'll have charge of the rehabilitation.
He'll be the ultimate administrator of those, yes.
Of that. Now, the referee in the evaluation division, is that where?
No, the referee, the hearings referee has been, under present policy, an independent division, which is comes out of the Workers' Compensation Board's budget, but however they have been an independent body. They will continue to have the same status. They will continue to be out of, their funding will continue to come through the board, but they will retain their independent status.
So
the director has no control either as far as budgeting or policy making over the referees.
So the referee will, in a chain of command type situation, will belong to the board.
Well, the referee, as under our current program, really couldn't be referred to as belonging to the board. They have, of course, once they're appointed, they have can only be removed for cause, so that they do maintain an independence.
Who appoints them?
Well, the board, and it is their budgeting basically comes through the board. But I think you should realize that they have been, under our present system, more or less an independent group of decision makers. They will continue to be that under 1050, and they'll be continue. Their budgeting will continue to come to the board.
They will have, but the rules
they will have to comply with the rules that are established by the board.
Well, that's currently our situation. They're basically there to make determinations on the facts.
And there's no change in the present status to what is proposed here in 1050.
No, they still have de novo review powers. They may take evidence. And
okay, one more question. If there is new information, once an appeal is made to the appeals court, it's based on the record.
The Court of Appeals?
Yes.
Yes.
It's based on the record.
It currently is. Today it's currently based on the record.
Yes, to the appeals court, but not to the circuit court. Circuit court, new information can come in. It's a whole new ballgame to the circuit court today, is it not?
The broker can make an appearance and enter whatever comments he has.
Okay, well, that's what. But when we shift it over to the appeals court taking this function, he cannot do that.
No, the review will be on the record, and it will be for on the substantial evidence test, which means that the court cannot substitute its judgment for the judgment of the administrative body. However, it can remand it, for instance, if there was not substantial evidence in their opinion to support whatever determination the board came out with. If there's a constitutional violation, that is something like due process, that would be a ground. If there is an error of law, that is, if the board has misinterpreted the terms of the statute as a matter of law, then the Court of Appeals would remand with instructions.
But what if at this stage of the game now, the appeal has been made to the appeals court, there has been new information come forward? Is there any way that can become a part of the process? Can it, if this...
It would be on the record that has been created.
No, it's something that once the record has been created...
I understand your question. Well, the board can, under present law, can open a case for reconsideration at any time on its own motion. And I would expect that in that sort of case, if there was new evidence, it would be back to the board and they would given a petition by the worker to reopen the case.
So even under 1050, the board on its own motion can reopen a case?
Yes, they can modify an award at any time. And if the award is decreased, there is full hearing rights under our present law. If the award is increased, no hearing rights, but the award can be modified.
Not having the disadvantage of being an attorney, I don't quite understand all this.
Well, the board, it's not, once the board makes a decision, there's no locked-in waiver of all future opportunities to present evidence or get a modification of your award or a modification of that original decision. It's not a once or nothing sort of shot. There is a continuing jurisdiction of the board over all of its determinations that it's made.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hey, yes, Representative.
When you say remanded, the Court of Appeals would remand it. That means that it goes back to the board.
It's
the
sent
board
back.
Has to open it back up and
yes.
Do it over.
And do it in compliance with the court order. If there's a determination that there's been a mistake of law or a error of procedure, then that would, of course, be entered into the court's opinion. That it would be sent back to the board, and the board would have to take into consideration the court's opinion, rehear the case, and comply with the standards. We won't have the situation, though, where the court sends back and says the award should be X amount of dollars, because they're no longer substituting that sort of judgment on the facts. They will be on matters of law will be the types of determinations they'll be making.
One of the matters of law would be it's substantial evidence or a matter of law, right?
Yeah.
If they determine that they did not have substantial evidence or enough evidence, then they could also remand it for that reason.
Yes, if the in their opinion the decision of the administrative body, the board had no had not been supported by substantial evidence, then they would be sent back together further evidence and make further findings before they could the decision would be final.
In the testimony in the Senate, there must have been some input from the Court of Appeals as far as the increased burden on the Court of Appeals. What are we looking at as far as increased burden of the Court of Appeals?
Well, that's really hard to determine because right now we have, of course, both to the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals, de novo review by both those bodies. And currently there are a relatively small percentage of cases getting past the Circuit Court to the Court of Appeals, and of course that's on de novo review. One would expect it to be less. The communications we got from the Court of Appeals is that had we taken the Circuit Court out and continued de novo review by the Court of Appeals, there would have been a problem with the burden of cases. We did not do that. We gave the Court of Appeals in this bill review on matters of law. And at that point, I think we did not receive any further communication that the burden would be too onerous.
Okay. One other question. Mm-hmm. There seems to be, I'm hearing from some people, not very many, but some people, regarding the constitutionality of what we are doing in 1050, that is taking away a person's, this is the way, what they're telling me, taking away the person's right to a trial before a jury, or...
Well, there is currently no trial before a jury. It's a trial before a judge.
Well, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Trial before a judge,
right.
Then. Which we are doing. And I just wonder, was the question raised on the constitutionality of it in the Senate?
Yes, we did. We did look at that. Of course, we're not taking away judicial review.
I understand that.
Typically, a decision by an administrative body will be reviewed by the courts on matters of law and substantial evidence. The workers' compensation system has been a, well, I hate to use the word anomaly because I think it was clearly the policy of the legislature at that time to provide a court hearing, but if you look at the workers' compensation law as an administrative system, which it is, if it was, for instance, seen in the same light as the administrative process that goes through DEQ or any of our other administrative processes, we would find that the courts are only reviewing administrative bodies on substantial evidence in matters of law. And, of course, there are many administrative bodies in the state which the legislature has established to make these kinds of decisions on people's property and personal rights. And in most instances, the legislature has limited the court review to constitutional and questions of law. So what we're doing is not unconstitutional because it would bring the workers' compensation system more into line with what we have in the other administrative systems as far as judicial review.
Do you feel that the statement that you made about what we are doing in 1050 not being unconstitutional, do you feel that that's been clearly established on the record in the Senate proceedings on this bill previously?
Yes. There is judicial review for constitutional questions and substantial evidence, which is the constitutional test for administrative decision.
You feel that question has been clearly answered?
Yes, I think at this point it's a policy question, not a constitutional question.
Thank you.
Kenny
Rogers?
I've got one more question, right? Under 1050, are we cutting out two de novo steps?
Currently?
Yes.
Yes. We're limiting judicial review to matters of law and constitutional questions, substantial evidence. Currently, we have two de novo hearings, one at the Circuit Court and one at the Court of Appeals.
Ben, any questions?
Thank you very
much.
Thanks,
Richard. Thanks. Keith Wilson? Was there? There he is.
Chairman, I'm Keith Wilson, Chairman of the Workman's Compensation Board. I haven't signed to testify in connection with Senate Bill 1050. However, now that I'm here, I'd like to mention in response to Representative Rogers' inquiry a few minutes ago concerning a chart display of the allocation of responsibility between the board and the director, assuming the passage of Senate Bill 1050. This chart has been handed to the committee, and you'll note that it's entitled House Bill 2658 as amended, but the distribution as displayed on this chart, I think, is identical under both 2658 in the House version and 1050, which you have before you from the Senate side. Mr. Bill Peterson, one of our referees, is with me, and Mr. Peterson took both Senate Bill 1050 and House Bill 2658, and not with the intention of changing any substantive provision of either bill, but with the intention and the purpose of reorganizing to plainly delineate the responsibilities as provided and contemplated by both bills, and has done some wholesale amendments which are now incorporated in the engrossed version of 1050, which you have before you. I want to emphasize that we made a deliberate effort not to change any of the substantive provisions of the bill itself. It was purely a matter of reorganization, clarification, and legal clarification of amendments and repeals and this type of thing of various sections of the ORS, which we felt were required to avoid conflict. There are, after that very exhaustive study that was made rather hurriedly, but albeit very thoroughly, I think, two or three minor areas which Mr. Peterson has picked up, which might be suggested to this committee as additional amendments. They do not have anything, again, to do with a substantive change of provisions of the bill, merely technical matters that the committee may wish to...
Keith, let me do this. You presented the diagram to us.
Yes.
There are some other people here that that are going to come and testify. What I'd like to do, they've come a considerable length of distance, and I would like to have them come up and testify, because we're going to go with 45 minutes, and then if we have time today, I'm going to call you both back up here. Okay. Mr. Larry Gilday.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Larry Gilday. I'm an attorney in Eugene, appearing in opposition or against the bill, Senate Bill 1050. I'll make my comments fairly brief. I'm concerned primarily with the appeals procedure which the injured workman has. Basically, and let me emphasize, I'm testifying on my own behalf, and my remarks and observations are based pretty much on my own personal experience. I've been practicing law in Eugene for approximately 15 years. The workman's compensation part of my practice is relatively minor. Our firm probably has no more than 10 to 15 pending cases at any one time. But we have consistently been involved in this area, and I have done quite a bit of work in it. The thing that I think you might want to take into account on this appeals procedure. I'll speak to that briefly, and I want to give you some of the reasons. In 1965, when the House passed out the version of this bill, which ultimately became the new workers' compensation bill, one of the major changes in the rights of the injured workman was to remove the right to a jury trial if he did not get a determination that he liked from the old SIAC hearing officer. Before this law was passed, we had the State Industrial Accident Commission, which appointed a hearing referee officer who took in formal testimony normally not on the record, and normally no record was made of the proceedings. After his termination, the injured workman had a right to file a complaint in the circuit court and obtain a trial by a jury on the extent of disability. When the bill originally passed out of the House, it went to the Senate, and the Senate held out for a jury trial for quite a while. And finally, I think it was pursuant to Bill Mischofsky's, who was lobbying at that time on behalf of the bill, pursuant to his request and as further negotiations, the Senate adopted this de novo review scheme as a trade-off on the jury trial idea. So what you had finally when this bill was passed out of the Senate was the guarantee and the commitment on the part of the Senate and the House, and the House then concurred in the Senate's changes, that instead of a jury trial, we will still give the injured workman an independent review by an elected judge in his own judicial district, that's to say the circuit judge of the district in which he resides and where the jurisdiction and venue would be. That judge, the idea was, that judge would have the power to review the entire proceeding and exercise his own judicial discretion in determining not only the facts but also the application of law. That was the policy of the legislature, and I mention that particularly because the fellow who explained the legislative intent and how it's being deviated from by the courts, I think, is entirely mistaken. The courts, the circuit courts, and in my opinion, the appellate courts, have construed the workers' compensation provisions very consistently with legislative intent at the time that the bill was passed. We do not have a system in the courts which has resulted in or which is being resulting in the courts administering this law. The court is applying the law that you people passed 10 or 15 years ago. The Senate Bill 1050 doesn't contain anything which would prevent a court from administering the bill. If a court is able to administer something under the present law, it would be under that law. What it does is prevents the de novo review, which was guaranteed by the Senate amendments to the original bill passed out of the House in 1965. Now, it seems to me that the main reason for eliminating this de novo review, if I understand the employers and the industries, position correctly, is twofold. One is that because of the review proceeding now existing, the administrative cost, both to the Workers' Compensation Board and to the insurance carriers, is high. And therefore, funds are being used for these administrative costs which might otherwise be available to paid injured claimants. The second reason that I've heard from insurance counsel is that there is a variation of methods by which people arrive at a determination of fact. In other words, all circuit court judges are different, and they may consider different things, and therefore there's no uniformity or consistency in case evaluation, therefore making it difficult for the insurance adjusters to evaluate the particular claim. The idea, then, is that we should consolidate the fact-finding with the board so that there's some consistency in philosophy and in approach to the fact-finding. And that precisely is what any claimant would be afraid of, because an injured claimant is not particularly interested in having consistency on issues of fact. And it is very important to the people who are injured and the people for whose purpose this bill is passed to have the right to an independent judicial review by a judge subject to election in an election where they can vote in their own judicial district. The thing that seems to me, if you're talking about wanting to reduce costs and reduce administrative costs, I see nothing wrong with separating the functions of the board and having a director. I think basically what the bill tries to do, in a somewhat awkward fashion, is create a policy-making board, such as, for example, school district or school board, and then a director who is supposed to administer that policy, and that's a sound administrative approach. It seems to me you might want to consider, if you want to reduce the cost of the appeals procedure, leaving the board entirely out of the judicial process. There is no logical reason, as I see the function of the board, as I see the appeal process, for having a hearing officer whose decision is appealed or can be appealed to the Workers' Compensation Board, and then having another appeal from the board to any court. Seems to me that a much more logical and perhaps cost-saving approach would be to have the hearing officer for the initial hearing have an appeal directly from the hearing officer to the circuit court, and I think that hearing should be de novo on the record. I think we ought to explain these terms de novo compared to substantial evidence. When we're talking about a de novo hearing, we're talking about a hearing on the record. It's not a hearing at which additional testimony is taken. Let me compare that. At one time before the district court was a court of record in Oregon, you'd have a trial in district court and an automatic appeal to circuit court. That was called a de novo appeal. But when you got to circuit court, you start all over. There was no record. You put on all your witnesses. When we're talking about a de novo hearing in this context with the workers' compensation statute, we do not have a de novo hearing in the sense that you put on new and different and additional evidence at the circuit court level. De novo means that the circuit court judge reads the record and evaluates the testimony and the evidence himself. And he is not required simply to support the findings of fact that the hearing officer makes. And that's the kind of de novo hearing that I'm talking about that was the trade-off, if you will, in order to get the Senate to vote for this bill in the first place in 1965. Now, if you're trying to reduce administrative costs, if you're trying to reduce the amount of time that it takes to get a final decision, you're going to get farther by going directly from the hearing officer to the circuit court, letting the circuit judge have a de novo review of the record, and then having a substantial evidence appeal to the Court of Appeals. There was a question asked about what about the time and the docket of the Court of Appeals, and it takes a long time now to get things through the Court of Appeals, unless you're appealing from a conviction on a criminal case, in which case most of them are affirmed on the record without an opinion. But where you're appearing in a situation where the court normally renders an opinion, it takes quite a while to get there. And you're going to save any time by eliminating the circuit court, because most circuit courts hear these cases fairly rapidly after they're filed. I can speak to experience only in the counties near Lane County, Douglas County, and Coos County. Most of the circuit court proceedings, if the parties themselves are ready, will be heard and will follow in 6 to 8 weeks the time the appeal is filed. Most of the delays, incidentally, are not caused by the docket control, but they're caused by the attorneys on both sides who aren't prepared and who have to have more time to prepare a brief. In the Court of Appeal, there's another factor that I think is important from a claimant's standpoint. You have to remember the claimant does not have the money with which to retain him as considerably more expensive than an appeal to the local circuit judge, because you have special court of appeals rules with reference to filing briefs. You cannot file the same type of informal memoranda in the court of appeals that you can in a circuit court. You don't have the same opportunity to present your case by argument in the court of appeals as you do in circuit court, because the court of appeals, you're limited by court rule to so much time. In circuit court, you can take whatever time is necessary to develop your argument before the judge. You can take a full day if that's warranted. You cannot do that in the court of appeals. Basically, you're really wiping out and reducing the appeals, claimant's right to have this judicial review. And so that primarily is the objection I see. There's one other factor that was brought up from Bill Rogers' questions about taking testimony at the circuit court level. Under the law as it is today, the circuit court judge has the power to permit additional testimony on medical issues if there's a showing that the testimony was not available at the time of the hearing or for some reason couldn't be produced. That provision is removed by Senate Bill 1050, thus preventing either party, either the carrier or the claimant, from presenting pertinent medical evidence which was developed or which came to their attention after the date of the hearing. The reason I mention this is you're dealing with workers' compensation in an area where you have injuries to people. Both sides, particularly the claimant, however, is anxious to get this case determined. You wind up, there's a strong effort made on the part of the evaluation section and the Workers' Compensation Board to wait until the medical condition is stationary before you have a determination order entered. That's the first step. Once that's entered, then you ask for a hearing. It is very common to ask for a hearing before your hearing officer, and after that date, and even after the date of the hearing and the hearing officer's opinion, to have medical conditions change. And they can change slowly, they can change rapidly. And it's frequently the case that we or the carrier will want to present additional testimony at the time of the circuit court hearing. I was involved in a case in Coos County not long ago in which the insurance carrier, the private carrier, produced or sought to produce additional testimony relating the psychological condition of the party, of the claimant. That would not have been to the claimant's best interest had the testimony been allowed, but that gives you an example that both sides can avail themselves of that procedure. And the court, the final determining body, ought to have such evidence before it in making its decision. Well, basically, that's, I think, the situation that I wanted to describe. I believe that the injured workman should have the safeguard of a de novo review in circuit court. He doesn't need it in the court of appeals. I can't see any logic to having a direct appeal from the board to the court of appeals, so that you've only got the court of appeals for judicial review. It may well reduce the number of appeals because most claimants can't afford that type of procedure, but it's not going to give the claimant what I think the legislative intent was, at least in 1965, and that was a fair and complete hearing on a determination of his disability. Basically, Ted, that was what I wanted to present.
Larry, the committee's heard testimony, the same position that you've stated has been stated by some other people before on House Bill 26, or the 58 that we've heard. I guess the thing is that I understand your position you said that you cannot see any logic in having an appeal from the board to the Court of Appeals, and guess that you would have to say that I imagine your position is it's illogical for all the other administrative hearings, whether it's unemployment, Employment Relations Board, or
any other
matter, in which that they have direct appeals from an administrative board to the Court of Appeals. But I take it that your distinction is because of the personal injury nature of the claim.
Well, sure. That and, okay, in saying I don't see the logic of it, as I understand the premise of the people who have this bill, who want this bill, we're trying to reduce expenses. If you're trying to reduce expenses, why not eliminate the board? You got three people there, and we don't need them to have to review this hearing officer's record. Why not give the injured workman a chance to have a de novo review by one judge in circuit court? Well, you only got one person reviewing the record. Why send it up to the board when we got three people?
Let me ask you this. Is another alternative to this that I have thought about for some time, and we're going to talk about it later this morning, is a workman's comp court, a three-judge panel, that the appeal would go from the hearing officer, it would go to an appellate, it's an appellate court of a three-judge panel that would be the workman's comp court, and they would have a de novo on the record. What would you think about that idea?
I guess I don't see the advantage to that. I'm not against the idea as you define it. I don't see the advantage to that over an appeal to circuit court. I guess my preference, when you're talking about de novo review, my preference is to have one person conducting that review. I really like the idea of a committee decision on facts. Well, I think basically it's a poor way to go. That's why when you have a trial lawyer who's got a real tough decision that has to be made on the facts, they're going to raise the jury every time, because you want the responsibility fixed for the judge. You don't want the collective decision that's going to be difficult to sustain. And I feel the same way on this. I would prefer, if I were trying a case, I would prefer to be able to argue before one judge rather than a panel of three. And it's been my experience also that where you have these panels, the tendency inevitably is that they're not prepared when they come up for review. And the circuit court normally is. The judge, at least it's been my experience, the judges normally have read the record, they've read the briefs, the memorandum has been filed, and they know what to ask, and they get right to the point. When you've had a three-panel review, even courts of appeals and Supreme Courts on occasion, you have a whole bunch of people sitting there, and many of them have not reviewed the record. And frequently, they will assign one person the job of reviewing it, and you take this case and get it prepared, so you can ask some questions of counsel when they get there, and then you have three people making the decision. And so my preference is to just have one person making it fully responsible for the decision.
Any other questions, Mr. Galdea?
We've got the referee hearing the case begin. Just what is done there? That's a single individual.
Okay, the referee. Yes, the referee really acts as a judge, I guess. as the record is made by tape recording presently. It's his job to rule on all legal issues that come up during the course of the hearing. The hearings are quite informal, and normally at a table like this, each side has the opportunity to present witnesses and other evidence. And basically, it's at that hearing where the claimant and the defendant have to present evidence which they want to urge should be the finding. If the evidence is not presented there, you've lost your chance. That's your day in court, so to speak.
Okay, now this is sworn testimony.
It's all sworn testimony.
You can have anyone that you wish to come testify or whatever.
Yes, and normally the way it's done today, the testimony is limited.
I mean, as a practical matter, to people who can describe what the injured claimant cannot do, they used to be able to do. In other words, demonstrating the degree of disability, except in your denial cases. In a case where the benefits have been denied, you frequently present medical testimony from a doctor, either by deposition or actually in person, in order to establish the causal relationship between the accident and the medical condition.
As a practicing attorney, what's your personal opinion of the qualification of the hearing aids officers that we presently have, the system as it works there?
I think it's good. Now, I think the hearing officers, by and large, do a very good job, as they are now. I think the system has been working fairly well. I agree that this de novo hearing perhaps overworked. I don't see a need for two or three or four of them. I do see a need for at least one. I think historically the need is justified because of the history of this entire thing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Mr. Is it Nelson Zeller?
I'm Nelson Zeller of Albany, Oregon, an employee of one of the pulp industry. I have about 4 years of general farming and logging my background, 20 years of construction, 20 years of the pulp industry, 22. During this time, I saw the old compensation law come and go. And it was a blow, as far as I'm concerned, to the employee when we lost the old compensation laws that were back in effect at, I believe, before 1965. The present law has worked better than I expected. In fact, I was very much opposed to the darn thing as a three-way situation. And now we're beginning to nibble away at the, as I see, the claimant's rights or privileges in the that's written into the law. I am firmly against the Bill 1050. The main part is, as was spoken in regards to the elimination of the circuit court and replacing it with the Court of Appeals. I can't see the justification. It has been my experience to have been in management as well as a equipment operator in construction, a steel worker, a millwright at the present time. And there's one thing that I think that we're all missing is the fact that the cost of the claimants that the employer is squalling about or making noises about is all borne by the fact that the injured workman is injured. And if you stop the injury end of it or work on that end of it, I think you'll have a great deal better results as far as cost is concerned. It looks to me as though the attempting is to get on the tail end of the cat and try to remedy it by chopping off a bit of the tail instead of pulling some of the teeth in the front end that's doing the biting. I wish I could speak as well as our attorney that just preceded me, but I can't. And I think I've expressed my opinion that I am firmly against the fact that you're pulling the circuit court out of the situation.
Are there any questions, Mr. Teller? George, go right ahead.
Have you been involved in a claim and had a bad experience, or are you injured now, or?
Anytime you have an injury, it's a bad experience, whether it's a car accident or what have you. Yes, I've been involved in them. If you follow this line of work, you're going to be damn lucky if, in fact, I got one of them when I was in management.
I wondered if you were involved in an injury or you represented employees that did have or something like that. I just wondered where you're coming from. I understand.
Where I'm coming from?
Mm-hmm.
Probably with common sense, I wouldn't spend my time down here because I only have one more year of working.
Yeah.
And I'll go on pension. But I am recovering from an injury that was done 40 years ago in the logging industry. It was taken care of, and then it fell apart about 5 years ago. And finally, it went to the point it had to be done.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Jones.
Gary?
I wonder why, and the question, I'm aiming this question to you, but I should have been asking it to everybody. I wonder why everybody feels like this change in procedure is going to be to the disadvantage of the injured worker. It seems to me like there's an automatic assumption being made that this change, and because we were eliminating the de novo reviews, that's automatically going to work to the disadvantage of the injured worker. And I haven't yet been convinced that that's actually going to be the case. I admit that that's fewer times when he might have the opportunity to have his benefits increased, but I'm not convinced at all that the end result is going to be, the long-term disadvantage to the injured worker. Just wondering if you have any thoughts. Why do you think that the elimination of these mobile reviews the appeals to the circuit court is going to be to the disadvantage of the injured worker? Give me a question.
Well, as previously stated, it was going to be more costly for number one thing, and when a workman is out of work, if he's injured, it isn't long until he's down the drain financially.
It's going to be more costly to him?
I feel it is, yes. Time-wise.
Seemed to me like he'd spend less time.
It could be. I could be wrong.
Well, so could I. Believe me.
I'm not...
I just wanted to get your reaction.
Sure. No, I feel that the individual, if he can be gotten back on the job, that's the first thing to accomplish. But and the quickest way is the best way, usually. Not always. I've seen men punching time clocks that were wearing a cast on their foot to cut down the state industrial's lost time claim.
Okay.
With the doctor's permission.
Okay.
And in some small towns where there is a industry that is the only industry, shall we say, that it's possible to influence judgment sometimes?
Mr. Zeller.
I have reservations about the director as one man, but as the ultimate, but for the simple reason he is appointed.
Mr. Zeller?
Yes.
Here, if you look at the blackboard, and this is the thing that they're trying to get at. Under the present appeal system, if you look at the bottom of the board, the workman appeals, and then he has a hearing before a hearing examiner. And then he has the right to appeal that to the workman's compensation board. And then he has the right to go to the circuit court. And then he has the right to go to the court of appeals. And then he has the right to go to the Supreme Court. And what they're doing is they're eliminating the circuit court position because it's felt that a five-step procedure like that is extremely cumbersome. And so, in essence, they're not replacing this Court of Appeals with the Circuit Court. All they're trying to do is to make a decision, and what Mr. Gilday, the gentleman here, talked before you, the dispute centers around whether the Circuit Court's going to be eliminated from that appeals process or the Workman's Compensation Board's going to be eliminated from the process. And that's the Court of Appeals is not replacing any of the other ones.
I follow that.
Okay.
You're taking one step out, as I see it, and it'll be a four-step procedure instead of a five.
And what Representative Wilcox...
In other words, what I'm trying to say is that you got four chances to win or lose instead of five.
And what Representative Wilhelms was getting at is he said he hasn't, in his mind, been able to determine why people think that taking the circuit court out of there is going to hurt the claimant anymore.
It may not. It might be better. I could be wrong. I have been many times. But this is my own personal opinion, and this is the way I feel.
Thanks, Bill.
Now, back to that, following that particular line, you had talked about a man's out of work and he wants to get this thing squared up. Wouldn't you think that taking a step out would speed the process up and accomplish that goal?
It's possible.
Okay.
But I wouldn't say that it's true.
Another thing, you've been in the workforce for a long time. You'd made a comment earlier about the teeth of the cat being the accidents that happen and should work on that. Over this period of years, have you seen an improvement in the work conditions and the safety?
I have seen improvements in the work conditions primarily due to, in my opinion, to contract negotiations. I have seen third step grievances filed to stop the use of asbestos dust after it had been publicized.
You don't believe that the accident prevention, the compliance part of it, you don't think that has played any part in cleaning up the problem?
Well, I would say that it has done a great deal, but I would say also that it could do a great deal more.
Okay, well,
and what I'm trying to say is that some companies have a safety program which is nothing but a paper tiger. It hasn't got a damn tooth in it.
We've had testimony on other bills before us and other matters that indicate that in some percentage of accidents that occur and on-the-job injuries that do occur, that this is the fault of negligence on the part of the employee who was injured or some other employee. Now, here we are back to the human factor, and very difficult to take that out of. You just reach a point of diminishing return. And because the employer right now is subject to some fairly severe penalties if they do not maintain a safe place to work. And yet we have no penalty other than the potential of being fired for the employee who violates some of these of his own accord.
This is very true. Would you believe in a factory that I was requested and required, or another employee was requested to walk a 12-inch beam that's 20 feet off the ground for about 5 years before they put a safety walk on it? And
fear of height,
this
would claim me there.
That ended up bitching that finally got it.
This, however, is not supposed to happen now.
Well, follow.
And this is what I'm saying, is that we have taken a great number of steps, and we're really down to the human equation, almost essentially.
On both sides, the human equation. Mm-hmm. One over here, so many dollars piled up to what you can do with, and they will spend. And when it costs too much over here, they will do it.
We can force the one on the one side to spend the dollars. We can't seem to force the one on the other to comply.
I follow what you're thinking.
Yeah.
And having been in management, I know what you're thinking.
I appreciate you coming up here today. You know, as I know that maybe you think that only because you got a year to go that it may not be worth your while. It is, though, for you to come up.
Well, I fought the three-way bill for one session. We kept it out. I was Flynn County Labor Council at the time, president.
Well, I think that most, there's a number of us up here that I think that your assertion about the safety and contract negotiations probably believe that you're correct on that issue.
I hope so. I do. I believe that. Thank
well,
you, gentlemen.
Just a second, Mr.
No, sorry.
No, I'm sorry. Not to you. I have a question that I would like. I would like to get the number of cases to go from the circuit court level up to the Court of Appeals. How many is...
In your file, you have an orange annual report of the Workman's Comp Board for fiscal year 76. Okay. On Exhibit 1, they have the summary of monthly statistical reports for fiscal year 76. The only problem with it is the specific question you asked isn't answered on those statistics, and that's from the circuit court to the Court of Appeals. They got the number of hearings before the referees, the number of hearings that appealed to the Workman's Comp Board, and the number to the circuit court. They do not have the number on the statistic for the Court of Appeals, but I'm sure Mr. Wilson can provide that to the committee.
I would like to have that.
Excuse me?
The other statement I would like to make to Representative Rogers, who's not listening at this time.
Bill, you are being better come and defend yourself.
I had to plot a little bit over here.
I think that Representative Rogers, that because we have passed a law, Senate Bill 44 of, I believe, the 1973 session, and supposedly required all workmen or all employers to provide a safe place of employment, that the only reason we now have industrial accidents is because of negligence on the part of the employee. I think that is the wrong assumption. I think also that the mere fact of passing the law does not necessarily mean that all employers comply with that law.
Representative Otto.
Mr. Dwyer, would you please, Mike, at this particular time, to identify yourself on the record?
Yes, I'm Bill Dwyer. I'm chairman of the Lane County Democratic Party. I live in Eugene. I have worked in construction most of my life, drove a truck. I worked for the AFL-CIO. I worked for the Teamsters, the culinary, the meat cutters, and the lots of different crafts. And I'm up here testifying in behalf of myself.
We're not going to hold any of that against you.
Okay, against this bill. First of all, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to present you with a Polish chainsaw.
You've been up here after me. You have to understand, he's my central committee. He's the chairman of our central committee down in the county.
My son made that. I figured it would suit you. You could buck some logs out in Junction City.
Thanks, Billy. I appreciate that. Okay. Now I'll turn off the tape recorder because we're not going to listen to it anymore. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I'm against this bill for a lot of reasons. More than we have time really to talk about. It's a bad bill. Not only is it a bad bill, it's a bad idea. I mean, it's the total idea. It does a lot of things that, like he said, to list the powers of the director, I don't think we'd have time to list them, or the blackboard wouldn't have the space, really, to put all the powers of the director under this bill. Well, some of the things that I'm really concerned about, you look at the process, the circuit court process, I think what that does, well, I look at it from an injured workman's point of view. I've been involved with them a lot of times. I worked with them. Is the fact that it's close to their county. It's a place where they can go and they travel. You know, when you're involved in litigation and you have to go to Salem if you live in eastern Oregon or if you live outside of the metropolitan area, when you're talking about legal fees, you're talking about lots of money to the workman. The fees, you know, are paid usually out of the you know, parts of it sometimes. It's set by the courts using the bar schedule now under the present system. It's to take that process out. The most critical aspect of the circuit court review, in my mind, is the fact that it keeps the referee and it keeps the board honest. Because the reason so many are in appeal is they know that if they don't make the right determination on the basis of fact, that there is a process by which the fact can be reviewed and then additional evidence also can be injected. And that's really the key. Now, you know, this really is just an insurance bill to me. I'm an insurance company bill. It doesn't benefit the injured workman one bit. And I don't know who's going to come up here and testify or really who's pushing this bill. But it doesn't benefit the people. It doesn't benefit the injured workman. Sure, it'll make costs a little less. It'll cut down maybe a lot of costs for the insurance industry because if the referees screw people over, it eliminates one process whereby they might be able to rectify the damage that was done. As far as the cost of like a labor court, that the only way that I could ever approve of that kind of a court is if it was on a county level, if we had one in each county, because we're going through the same process. Now, this bill just sets up a czar, one person that's called the director under this bill that has powers that are just phenomenal, unbelievable. And, you know, funny thing about it, there's a lesson really to be made from this thing that, this House just went through a turmoil whereby supposedly the attack was the power of the Speaker in doing everything, you know, and the fact that he didn't listen or he was irresponsible or maybe he wasn't sensitive. I don't know. There's as many people as you talk to, you get as many answers. And yet what this bill really does is establish the same type of a situation, only we call the person the director. It's bad news. It's bad news for the working man in more ways than one. The de novo power review process is needed. We talk about rapid decisions in the Court of Appeals. I hear the counselor for the Senate. I know he's never been in the Court of Appeals, or he sure couldn't say that. You know, I'd like you to really look into the time structure. You're talking about, you're hearing a lot of industry, a lot of insurance rhetoric about cost. When you get right down to it, you're talking about cost benefit to them, and not really any convenience to the working man or justice. And that's what I'm more interested in. I'm more interested in justice. Now, I was involved in the three-way bill, and I thought it was a heck of a stroke of compromise when the people compromised the jury trial for the review process. So like an axe, you want to whittle away at the process. And that's historical in the insurance industry. I mean, I'm just telling you the way I think. The people are really getting fed up with it because they're getting legislated and axed by people that have power, and it's just unbelievable. You talk about no cost. If you get hit sitting in your car and you get rear-ended, and it wasn't your fault, you've got to buy compulsory insurance because the other guy hit you. And they set some rates that are phenomenal because you can't go out in the free market and buy them because they control the whole structure. And it's unbelievable. I'm more concerned about the working man. I'm more concerned about justice in the review process. And I want that process whereby we have a judicial review process close to the person's home by an elected judge that can at least keep the referees honest. I know they're doing a fine job
But you look at the situation. They're doing a good job because the system hasn't degenerated to the point where they might be able to be a little lax or have somebody adopt administrative rules. If any of you have dealt with administrative rules and appealed administrative decisions under the Administrative Procedures Act, you're talking about a whole new ball game. You know that you can't get attorney's fees even in mandamus or writ of review. It doesn't allow for it. So what you're talking about is justice comes to those that have the ability to pay a lot of money. Sure, if you felt you were being treated unfairly and you got a lot of bucks, you can fight the system. But that's not the case with workmen, and particularly injured workmen. I'm more concerned with taking that money and providing them with decent care. The real culprit is inflation in medical costs. And sure, they say, well, look what the costs are. The insurance industry, they use their actuary tables and everything. They make some bad investments in Wall Street, and they got to make up with it by showing their losses. And they claim that, well, it's happening because of premiums. And that's not the case. But really, the culprit is inflation. And that's having an impact on the cost. I think the system's working very well, and I don't think it needs to be changed. I don't think we need a labor court, and I don't think we need Senate Bill 1050. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Bill. Go ahead, Bill.
You said that all the powers that are given to the director couldn't be put on the blackboard. Would you tell us some of those powers that you see coming under this bill?
Well, this bill, it's unbelievable. The powers, it says about hearing the referee. Somebody mentioned the fact that, well, no, he doesn't, he was really sensitive about him appointing. He can only remove the hearing referee with a court approval, you know.
No, the director can't do that.
Why can't he?
Because that's not one of his powers.
He can do it if he wants to do it under this bill, and if the referee doesn't like it, the referee can go to court and he'd have to show cause.
Can the director remove him, or is it the workman's comp board that removes him?
It's that, the brackets, if I read this correctly, brackets deletes it and bold type adds it. Is that correct, Mr. Kurigowski?
Yes.
Well, then it says director, and it deletes board.
Okay. Where is this that you're looking at?
Through the whole bill.
I realize that,
I didn't underline all these highlights.
We're going to start now. We're going to have another turn.
I read it in there.
Okay. I'd like to make a comment. I think you're wrong in what you say about the powers. The director under this, and I've been through the bill and read it very carefully, basically the director has a completely administrative function.
Well, I don't know how many bureaucracies you've been involved in, Mr.
The Brown. Board currently has this administrative function. The director will now have that administrative
function. Well, collectively, I think them functions are good, but when you center that power or function, you call it functions or whatever name you want to give it, or authority, I call it power in one person. I think that you're making a big mistake.
I'd be interested in you making a list of all these powers and giving it to the committee.
Bill, this bill is going to be set for another hearing, and I'm going to...
Good, maybe I can prepare something.
Would you leave the clerk with your name and address and everything, or your phone number, she can call you.
I'll be glad to do it for you, Mr. Rogers. I'll be glad to summarize all the problems I see with this bill. I think it ought to die. It ought to be tabled.
Thank you. Bill, on behalf of all the other, those of us of Polish nationality, I saw where Mr. Kolonowski took out the door because he didn't want to come in.
Well, you can lend it to him. He can come with him in the weekend.
Well, I doubt if it would pass the OSHA safety requirements, and I'm quite sure that Jack wouldn't want to do anything like that.
Okay, thank you.
Listen, before we go, there's four of us. I have a bill to be introduced. There's a bill that the Attorney General has
been working on for about a month and a half, and it's just gotten to this point, and it's relating to the establishment of an employment practices claims revolving fund for the purpose of providing funds for settlements and judgments arising up from claims against the state of Oregon, its agencies and employees, by persons alleging employment discrimination as prohibited by the state or federal law. Interestingly enough, what it deals with is that once they get into the negotiations on these discrimination claims with the EEOC, they have no fund where they can take the money out to effectuate the settlement, and they would like that bill introduced. Is there any objection?
Yes.
You don't want to have it introduced?
Hmm?
No, okay.
I object to the introduction of the bill.
Okay.
Not on principle of the...
The merits of the...
Not on the merits of the legislation, on the fact that, I told you before, the Rules Committee, I think it's getting too late to introduce the significant legislation.
Okay. That's okay. I'll wait until I get the fourth member.
Make you honest, Lewandowski.
You delay me one day. That's what you do.
Did you get what's the...
I checked with the chairman of the Rules Committee, and he said to get it, to go through the procedure to get it introduced here, it'd have to come to the Rules Committee.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to have to go up there.
Then what do you even need to bring it up here for?
Because I want to get it introduced once I get the Rules Committee to agree to introduce it, of which you will do then.
My position is
okay. Listen, 10:50, I want a time set for an evening session next week. Tuesday night is the Trailblazer game. I was going to set it for Tuesday night, and I figured I'd be the only one here.
Oh, I don't like sports.
George will be the only one here, then.
Representative Bottle, while you were gone,
I'm mad at him because he wouldn't let me put my resolution in the other day. But you wouldn't.
Representative Otto, do you have any objections to the introduction of a bill here I need to have introduced?
None whatsoever. None whatsoever.
This bill is.
I thought you said it had to be introduced through the Rules Committee still.
Well, it is. It's still going to be. I mean, it's introduction sort of being the record. I'm glad you showed up at the time you did. What time would the members of the committee like to set up as night sessions? What days of the week? We've tried to go through this, and it's obvious that no one can agree as to when they'd like to be here in the evening. Tuesday, I would rather not do it because of the ball game, because I know there's a lot of people going to be gone.
Wednesday
evening?
Wednesday would be satisfactory.
Okay, Wednesday.
I really don't care, Mr. Chairman, other than ball game nights.
Okay, Wednesday I will set up a meeting. It will be a hearing on 10:50 and 10:48. And I doubt 10:49 is over here by then.
No.
It's not going to be here. There will be some more workman's comp bills put on at that time. And you can pick up the agenda.
What time do you plan on starting, Mr. Chairman?
7 o'clock.
Wednesday
evening.
Do you have a quick time, or are we just going to go on indefinitely?
I will give a quick time by 10 o'clock, if not sooner.
Okay.
Now, the other thing I'd like to do before we leave is you've probably seen the paper that the speaker has had an inquiry on this idea of a workman's compensation court. I think the wording in the paper, who was who, got kind of mixed up, and I have for some time been working over the last year on the idea of a labor court, let me put it that way. And my position has always been that I think that the people of the state would best be served if there was one court which handled all employment matters. And I was going to ask an interim study this session, because I had it worked up, to undertake a review of a court that would handle workman's comp, unemployment, collective bargaining, discrimination, minimum wage, everything. Now, it's obvious that the speaker has requested that at this particular time that we look at the possibility of it relating just to the workman's comp board. I have told him that I am willing to do that, and I would like Mr. Wilson
to look at Senate Bill 1050, and I would like to try to establish some amendments within this parameter. A three-member labor workman's comp court.
Elected or appointed?
Elected. They would be elected, and what the bill would basically do, what I envision, is to eliminate the workman's comp board and the circuit court both from the hearing process and put this in its place, and in the Court of Appeals process, because they would be going directly from the hearing examiner to the labor court, and then the appeal would be to the Supreme Court from there. My own personal opinion is that I think it's extremely late in the session to think of an idea like this, but I have told the Speaker that I would look at it, and I would like to try it. Chuck, I'll get with you, and we'll look at it to try to formulate it into a position so we can take testimony. Dave? Yes, de novo to the labor court. Is there anything else to come before the committee?
Legislative Council Committee's meeting on Wednesday night. That may not make a conflict for anybody but me, but I do have a conflict.
Okay. You never attend anyway, do you?
Faithfully.
Yeah.
But I it would be easy to come over here and stay away from there. It would be easy to stay over there or go over there and stay away from here.
Do you know, just for your own information, place that I have probably read enough on a labor court, but they have a very elaborate system, is Israel. They have a very interesting system for handling all labor problems, and that's what I would like to really see the state of Oregon one of these days to move to that concept. I think it would be much better for both the citizens and the administration of all the laws that relate to employment. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Hearing none. We're done.